Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Thomas Hegghammer, the director of terrorism research at the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment.
Thomas and I talked about the new Islamic State-focused special issue of the academic journal Perspectives on Terrorism and Hegghammer's article in it, Assessing Islamic State's Commitment to Attacking the West, that he co-wrote with Peter Nesser.
Thomas is the author of Jihad in Saudi Arabia, Violence and Pan-Islamism Since 1979, among other books. And stay tuned after the interview for an updated hashtag social media segment.
Thanks for coming on to the show today, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
So today, which is Wednesday the 5th, those who are listening will probably be last week on Wednesday, a new issue of Perspectives on Terrorism is coming out, and it's chock full of a bunch of new articles about the Islamic State from a number of different researchers. And this was as a result of, you know, you coming together with this conference in Oslo about 2 months ago. I was just wondering, why did you conceive of this idea for the conference originally about the Islamic State, and then for it to, you know, for those who participate, including myself, to write these articles for the journal?
Well, the reason for having the conference is quite simply that I felt that in the spring of spring of this year, we were basically at war with an enemy that we don't really understand, because the research on Islamic State and its kind of previous incarnations had been very limited in the years leading up to the capture of Mosul last year. There was a lot of research in the mid and late 2000s on Al-Qaeda in Iraq and so on. But then it sort of stopped. And there were still a few people working on it, but there was a lot less coming out. And as a result, we don't really have much research on kind of ISI and ISIS in the years sort of from 2008 to 2014. So, and then, of course, the intervention happened in August 2014, and we found ourselves involved in a conflict against this organization that I felt that we really didn't understand. And so I wanted to bring together some of the best minds that I could think of in the field and in related fields for a good discussion about this. And the reason I wanted to get people to write papers is quite simply that I wanted there to be new insights, new research. There have been a large number of kind of roundtable discussions and seminars and so on Islamic State throughout the past year. Very often these take the form of just discussions. People come and kind of present their views and analyses, and then they leave us. And there's not always new research being brought to the table. And I wanted to have that at this conference. And I was very glad that so many great people could attend and were able to produce these excellent papers, which should be coming out any time soon.
Yeah, I think it's the quickest turnaround for any academic type of exercise. Usually, people writing papers takes forever, and then editing it to actually come out in a journal article takes probably at least a year later. So it's great that the turnaround was really merely months. And for those who are interested, it's an open source academic journal, so you don't need to pay for it. And if you just Google Perspectives on Terrorism, you should be able to find it online. And there's about 165 pages worth of new research. So it's I'd highly recommend it. And those who wrote these papers, their presentations were phenomenal 2 months ago. Shifting to the article that you wrote with Peter, called Assessing the Islamic State's Commitment to Attacking the West, you sort of were looking at all these different types of connected attacks to the Islamic State, whether it's, you know, people who are inspired, whether it's people that might have had some contact with people on the ground there, but it wasn't directed, and then the possibility of a directed attack. You broke up the paper into a number of different sections, so I just wanted to go through each one, maybe tease out a little bit about the research you came up with and some of the new insights you had. So the first section, you looked at sort of the stated intentions of the Islamic State and their supporters, breaking it down between the foot soldiers, videos that they've put out, Dabiq magazine, as well as speeches by Abu Muhammad al-Adnani and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. So I was just wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about some of these stated intentions up until you wrote this paper.
Sure. Yeah, I should maybe say first kind of what the objective was. And
Sure, yeah.
The paper is basically our take on this big question of whether Islamic State is going global or not. That is it going to pose the same kind of threat to terrorism threat to the West as Al-Qaeda did in the 2000s? Obviously, this is a big concern for policymakers, and there's some debate also in the jihadi studies field, I suppose, about this. And there's also conflicting, you know, media reports with a steady stream of newspaper articles saying, you know, reporting on some IS-linked plot here or an IS-connected plot there. And so we wanted to kind of dig deeper into this and figure out sort of, you know, exactly what has happened. What has IS done internationally? Because clearly this is not a question of either or, whether or not they have done international operations. They have done some things, so it's a matter of degrees, and we wanted to kind of pinpoint that a little bit better. So we do three things, basically, in the paper. We look first at stated intentions, and then we look at the kind of the total number of IS-linked attacks and kind of their features. And then in the third part, we try to look at what types of IS-linked attacks are we dealing with. What is the nature of the connection? Like, what does connected or linked mean in each specific case? And we provide this sort of new typology. We'll get to that later in the podcast, I suppose. So on intentions, this is kind of the briefest, least kind of comprehensive part of the paper. Is we do this just to kind of scrape the surface, get a sense, rough sense of what IS has been saying, and kind of the broad features of their messaging with regard to terrorism in the West. And this is obviously, it's difficult to summarize what IS has said, because IS is a big thing, and it does produce a lot of statements, especially if you include the tweets and kind of side remarks of foot soldiers on various social media. So we basically took a sort of a smorgasbord of different types of statements. We looked at just sort of a collection of tweets and interviews and that kind of thing by foot soldiers in IS. Then we looked at a collection of a little over 200 videos produced by IS in late 2014 and early 2015. We looked at Dabiq magazine, and we looked at all of the statements of Baghdadi and al-Adnani, from late 2014 and the first half of 2015. And generally speaking, you know, with some exceptions, what we find is that that IS is sort of declaring a general hostility to the West, and is clearly keen to see terrorist attacks happen in the West, but they're not very specific about whether or not they're currently planning, you know, or organizing major attacks themselves. You have foot soldiers, for example, you know, boasting about the fact that there will, you know, we will see the black flag on 10 Downing Street and on the White House, and so on and so forth. You know, we had this sort of, you know, Twitter campaign last year, you know, promising attacks, you know, worse than 9/11 in America if America got involved in Iraq again and so on. So clearly, you know, a desire there to see harm inflicted on the West in some way. But these are only foot soldiers. So I think we have to move up the food chain if we want to get to kind of, you know, strategic intentions. And so then, you know, videos is one step up, I suppose, in the food chain, is because videos are presumably produced by cadres that are, you know, in the middle of the organization. And what's interesting there is that you obviously have these, you know, a few videos that explicitly threaten Western countries, and you have these decapitation videos of American hostages and so on. But they're only a very small proportion of the total output. And this echoes what you find in your paper in the same special issue, Aaron, which is that what the Western media tends to highlight is only a fraction of the overall output, and that IS, in fact, talks a lot more about other things than kind of threats against the West in their overall production. So we don't see that the kind of the video corpus of IS, you know, is particularly obsessed about kind of, you know, warning about impending attacks in the West. And in the Beak magazine, there is a little bit more. They quote from they reproduce this famous call by al-Adnani from September last year for attacks by sympathizers against all kinds of Western targets. And they also produce some other kind of general sort of threats. And De Beek also sort of claims a number of attacks by, for example, celebrating the perpetrators of attacks, like the attack in Copenhagen or in France in January, or Australia or Canada. They take all these, you know, names that became famous with, you know, with these attacks, and they claim them as kind of IS heroes, although it's not clear in each of these cases from the investigation whether there really was any prior direct link, whether there was communication between these people and IS before the attack. But Dabrik is kind of claiming them as their own, which suggests that they're, you know, they're keen to see more of this kind of thing. And then when we look at the kind of the two main voices, now we are in the top of the food chain. They were seeing, you know, actually two very different messages. Al-Adnani is the most explicit about kind of impending IS attacks in the West. He's the one who issued this famous sort of individual jihad call in September, and he also has a couple of statements that, you know, could be interpreted, you know, to mean that something, you know, that a big directed attack might be coming. So he says, for example, in January, that, you know, something like what lies ahead will be worse because you haven't seen anything from us just yet. In fact, that particular statement is probably the most ominous threat that I found, the most kind of most explicit, you know, thing that might point to kind of an intention of a strategic kind of central attack against the West. But is and he also says you know, similar things in his other statements. So what Adani is saying is worrying, that's for sure. Al-Baghdadi, on the other hand, doesn't explicitly threaten as much as al-Adnani it does. He doesn't really talk that much about the West or about America in his statements. And when he does, he doesn't explicitly say, we are coming to attack you or something like that. You know, he's saying, we will win, we will defeat you, and you will suffer and that kind of thing. But he's not very explicit. So there's less in his statements, but even if you kind of combine the Baghdadi and Adani statements, we still don't have, you know, the same type of rhetoric as Al Qaeda produced in the years before and after 9/11. In that period, Bin Laden was saying things that were more explicit. And more explicitly committed the organization to major attacks in the West. And I'm going to bring in a couple of Bin Laden quotes for comparison there. So the sense that I'm left with after reading and reviewing all this stuff is that yeah, they would like to see things happening, but they, you know, they're not quite as hell bent on it as Al Qaeda was.
Yeah, definitely, But, you know, one of the interesting things is that up until Adnani's speech last September, we didn't really see any attacks that were inspired by the Islamic State until then. Do you see that as sort of just random? You know, do you see it more as just a correlation? Or do you think there is some causation there in terms of Adnani coming out with that speech in late September talking about individual jihad, and then, you know, in the following months, there was then a spate of either successful or, stopped, inspired type of attacks in different parts of Western countries?
Well, you know, it's hard to be 100% sure.
Yeah, of course.
But I think we can be pretty damn sure, if you excuse my language, that the statement had something to do with it, simply because the increase is so sudden and so sustained.
Yeah,
you know, in the 2 years before September, you don't have any kind of sympathizer, IS sympathizer, or ISIS sympathizer attacks in the West, and then afterwards, you know, you have around 20, And it suddenly starts then in September. I just can't think of any alternative, you know, explanation, anything else that happens around that time that would that might explain this. I guess the kind of there's some background, you know, factors here. You know, the general progress of the Islamic State, the declaration of the caliphate, the kind of general momentum that IS has, that probably plays into it. It gives, you know, it's by sort of, you know, making the call more worth heeding. But I think kind of the call itself is pretty influential here.
Yeah. So maybe we could get a little bit into the numbers now then related to this and some of the features of these IS related plots.
Sure. Yeah. So, I don't know how much detail you want here, because we could get into a lot of numbers, but just to kind of outline things, we're looking at the period from early 2011 to mid 2015. And in this period, sort of 4.5 year period, we have 69 plots of any jihadi plots of any kind, of any affiliation in the West. And by West, we mean North America, Western Europe, and Australia and New Zealand. So 69 plots. And we basically find sort of an IS connection to 30 of those 69 plots. However, nearly all of those kind of IS connected plots, you know, happened in the past 12 months. So if we look just at the, you know, the 12 month period from mid 2014 to mid 2015, then about 80% of all jihadi plots in the West had an IS connection. So 26 out of 33 jihadi plots in the West this past year had an IS connection. So it's clearly the dominant inspiration. I don't want to say the dominant player, because we don't yet know, you know, whether it's all organized, but it's, we can certainly say that it, you know, they're the biggest inspiration, because we see that many people, that many plotters expressing some kind of support for IS, you know, in the before or during the attack. So IS, you know, clearly seems to have kind of surpassed Al Qaeda as the main source of inspiration. And what's interesting also is that the execution rate of these IS linked attacks is very high. It's you know, almost 40%, which is extremely high in kind of as far as plots in the West go. And that probably has to do with the fact that many of these plots involve, you know, very simple means, you know, a knife or something like that, and few people, one or two people, so they were very difficult to kind of spot by intelligence services. So we have basically seen in the past year, it was just a wave of jihadi plots, but there are the plots that are mostly relatively small. Another kind of interesting thing that we talk about, and I know this interests a lot of people, and that is the role of foreign fighters in these plots in the West. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about Syrian foreign fighters potentially, you know, becoming terrorists later on, and our data can speak to that. Although, you know, it's still very early. We're still still actually far too early to really kind of settle the accounts on the blowback and sort of blowback effect. But what we find is a very small effect. There have been very few plots where a returnee foreign fighter from Syria has been involved. We only identified 9 plots where we can be reasonably certain that a Syria veteran has been involved. Now, when we know, those 9 plots involve about 11 people. So, in this, you know, account, and it's a particular type of count, and I encourage, you know, the specially interested reader to go in and to read our kind of methodology here, because we use a very conservative approach and we may not have captured all of the cases. But if we consider, if we take this, this number of 11, so 11 attacking, 11 are plotting returnees from Syria. That's a very small proportion of the total number of Western foreign fighters in Syria. And I think, I suppose the consensus these days is that somewhere around 4,000 people have gone to Syria at some point between 2011 and now. So, you know, 11 out of around 4,000 is a very small, very low blowback rate. And even if we assume that we have missed a lot of cases, it could well be that a lot of the kind of preemptive arrests and sort of arrests of returning foreign fighters on counts other than plotting, you know, has reduced the number of kind of plotting returnees that turn up in the data. But even if we say, let's say we've missed, you know, 2/3 of the plotting returnees, we're still only at sort of, you know, 30, 40 people, so less than 1 in 100. So, the Syria war is, you know, hasn't produced a wave of foreign fighter instigated plots in the West. We can say that for sure. But and also, I mean, I don't think that the blowback rate will necessarily increase a lot because the number of people going to Syria is still high. So even if we get, you know, let's say 10 more people plotting in the next year, you know, there might be another 1,000 going, you know, offsetting the kind of the rate. So we won't, I don't think the rate will reduce until the flow of foreign fighters stops and kind of people start trickling back. But so far the data show that the blowback rate is low.
And how would that compare to previous conflicts or zones where there have been a number of foreign fighters, whether it's, Afghanistan or Yemen, even Somalia?
Yeah, so this rate would be much lower than that for AFPAC in the 2000s, for example. But it's roughly in line with Iraq in the 2000s or Somalia in the late 2000s, because also in those conflicts, there were very few people, very few foreign fighters who returned to plot. I know that I am kind of often kind of attributed to the sort of 1 in 9 ratio, but this ratio is often misunderstood for various reasons. One is that the 1 in 9 is really a maximum estimate, and I say so explicitly in the APSR article that the rate probably is lower because I'm using a very low, in that article I use a very low estimate for the number of outgoing foreign fighters, and so the kind of the denominator on that fraction becomes very low, and so you get kind of an unnaturally low, or sort of an unnaturally high blowback rate. So the real historical average is probably a bit higher than that, maybe in the order of one in 15 or 20. So that's one misunderstanding. The other misunderstanding is that the blowback rate has varied a lot between destinations over the years. And so we have always said from the start of the conflict that we cannot extrapolate this historical average to an individual conflict like Syria. You have some conflicts in the past, like, as I mentioned, Somalia and Iraq, that have a very low blowback rate. And then some conflicts like AFPAC or to some extent Yemen with a very high blowback rate. And it's really hard to, you know, to say in advance, you know, whether a conflict like Syria is going to be a high or low blowback destination. And so far the data suggests it's a low blowback destination. But of course this could change. I in my previous writings, I've said that I think the most important variable here is the strategic intention of the host group in the destination. So, you know, whether you get a big blowback depends on whether there is a group in the theater that systematically weaponizes foreign fighters. And you had that in AFPAC, and you had that in Yemen. You didn't have that in Somalia and 2000s Iraq. So you know, if IS should, you know, change its strategy and, you know, go fully global and start weaponizing its foreign fighters systematically, then yes, I think the rate will go up very substantially. But so far, again, I'm preempting the conclusion here. So far, I think they haven't.
Yeah, and I guess it also depends whether Jabhat al-Nusra decides to do external operations as well in some ways, since I know that they had that interview with Al Jazeera, I don't know, it was maybe a month or two ago now, where Jawlani was saying that Zawahiri told them not to do any of that stuff and that they should focus on the Assad regime. But as we know, you know, Al-Qaeda has historically been focused on external operations. So if they decide to turn the switch, and they definitely do have foreign fighters as well, obviously not as many as the Islamic State, that could play a factor and role too in the future, potentially.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But there is there's another factor that kind of suggests that the rate, you know, will be low, which is simply that, you know, politicians and security services are much more aware of the threat from foreign fighters now. So this is probably the first conflict in which security services in the West have really been watching carefully from the start all of the foreign fighters who've left. So you know, a lot of the people down there, you know, are on the radar in some way for the authorities, and that wasn't necessarily the case for previous destinations. And so, and also that same awareness of the threat has, you know, led some countries to have a pretty aggressive preemptive strategy where they, you know, take the people, the returnees they consider the most dangerous, off the street, not necessarily by charging them with plots, but by charging them with, well, support for IS or something else. Just to have them out of circulation. And that kind of, I think, will reduce the ability of these organizations to weaponize foreign fighters. But this is not to say that foreign fighters, you know, are not dangerous. As I just indicated, there's an endogenous effect here that, you know, our own perception of them as a threat and the measures we take against it is one of the reasons why the blowback rate is low.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, previously a lot of debate within the field in relation to attacks or plots in the West were always about, you know, these directed or inspired plots, but within your paper, you provide this typology that's a bit more nuanced. There are six different categories. And I was wondering if you could just lay out and define a little bit about these different types of plots or attacks that are possibilities or that we've seen thus far related to these IS connected or inspired or however you want to describe it over the past year, and how this differs in some ways from previous work on this type of topic.
Sure. So one of the main things we've learned the past 15 years is that the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the people acting in Al-Qaeda's name can be very complex. We have a number of different types of, you know, possible connections and degrees of inspiration or guidance or training or weaponizing or whatever, you know, going on between kind of the mother group on the out, you know, the mother group in the East and the operatives in the West. And people have we've all been struggling with this for, you know, to make sense of these very complex relationships for a very long time. And so far, I think we haven't really had a good framework to kind of make sense of it. And I think perhaps the best known one so far has been the, you know, this distinction between top down and bottom up instigated plots. And we, you know, many listeners will know the polemic between Bruce Hoffman and Mark Sageman. And I think if that polemic, you know, showed us anything, it was that this distinction is not particularly fruitful, because very often a plot can be seen as, you know, as both top down and bottom up at the same time, and which one you emphasize depends, you know, is in the eye of the beholder. Because the kind of it was because the that typology wasn't developed enough. It didn't come with, you know, observable criteria, so that, you know, two analysts looking at the same case could end up coding the same case differently, looking at the same information. And so you just had, you know, end up in a situation where people, you know, just like with Hoffman and Sageman, just argued over and over and over again about whether it's one or the other. So I don't think that really brought our understanding of this sort of relationship between the mother organization in the East and the operatives in the West very far. So that's why we try to develop something else that can capture the fact that kind of organizational influence is a matter of degrees, is not categorical. So it's not the question is not, you know, where does Al-Qaeda have a role in this plot or not? It's, you know, to what degree is it involved? What type of involvement are we dealing with? And so we need something more nuanced. We need more than two categories. So we propose six, where the first is what we call training and top level directives. This is sort of, you know, the 9/11 type plot, where the top leadership of the organization grooms an attack team and sends them over to attack. The second one is what we call training and mid-level directives. And this is when you have a person who goes out, say, to Afghanistan and trains with, you know, Al-Qaeda or a related group. And then, you know, he gets some kind of encouragement from mid-level cadres, you know, the trainers or other people that he meet in these sort of circles, to do, you know, something back in the West, but the attacker doesn't have an interaction with the leadership. He's not taken on board as kind of a major project, and he doesn't kind of get much material support from the group. And examples of this would be, for example, the various plots linked to the Abu Doha network in the 2000s, or the Mohammed Mera attacks in 2012. The third category is what we call simply training, and this is when a person goes, you know, as a foreign fighter to a place like Afghanistan or Yemen, and trains with the group. But he doesn't receive any instructions or anything. He returns and kind of develops the motivation to attack kind of on his own. He's often, in the belief that he's doing what the organization wants, but he's kind of not taking specific instructions. There are several examples of this as well from Al-Qaeda history. The fourth category is what we call remote contact with directives. And this is when the attacker, you know, he's not a foreign fighter. He doesn't go out to train with the group, but he communicates with them bilaterally, you know, either via email or telephone or social media or something else. But one on the line, this is, you know, it's more than propaganda consumption. This is communication with a person at the other end. From the organization. In this category, that person at the other end, you know, instructs the candidate back in the West to attack. And a classic example of this is the Rajib Karim case in 2010. It was instructed by Anwar al-Awlaki via encrypted email to attack airline targets in the UK, using his British Airways job to do that. And the fifth category is what we call remote contact without directives. And this is when the person in the West communicates bilaterally with someone in the organization, but doesn't receive any instructions. Which kind of, you know, is a level closer to the group than if he was just consuming propaganda. But it is not; it hasn't got any specific instructions from the group. And an example of this from AQ history would be Nidal Malik Hassan, the Fort Hood attacker, who communicated with Omar al-Maliki. But for all we know about that correspondence, he wasn't instructed to attack. He developed that intention and then the logistics of the plot himself. And the final sixth category is what we call this sympathy, no contact. And this is when the person simply consumed the propaganda of the group. He hasn't gone to train with them, and he hasn't communicated bilaterally with them. And there are lots of examples of this too. And one would be, for example, Roshan Ara Chowdhury in Britain, who stabbed Stephen Timms in 2010 after having listened to a lot of al-Maliki sermons. And for all we know, she had no other direct communications with AQAP. So we have this sort of six-pronged typology, and it's just a suggestion. We're not; it's our best effort, but we are, we realize that it may not be the final word on this, and it could be that it needs to be further refined or modified. But it's the basic idea is that we need something a little bit more complex than this sort of top-down or bottom-up thing. And what we do with this typology is, we take all of these 30 IS plots that we identify in the 2011-2015 period, and we code them for type of connection. For each case, we look at the available information of the plot, and we say, we assign to it, either type 1 or type 4 or type 6 to each case, and we do the counts and see, how many do we have of each. And the point of the exercise is to see, whether you have a lot of what a lot of plots where the leadership is highly involved, you'll have a lot of type 1 or type 2 plots, or whether most of them are of type 5 or 6, where there's low involvement. And also, whether there's any change over time, whether we see more central leadership involvement or less over time. So we plot these also on a chart with time on the on the x-axis to try and get to that. And the bottom line is most of the plots are at the lower end of the spectrum. There are some type 2 plots where there does seem to have been instructions from mid-level cadres in IS, but it's only a handful of plots. And most plots are in the lower end of the spectrum. That's one major observation. And the other end, the other is that we don't really see any clear trend over time. If we're talking about degree of involvement, we end up with a rather messy diagram that maybe vaguely points downward, but it's I think it doesn't really tell us much as yet. But it does tell us things like the fact that sympathizer attack, which would be our category 6, increases sharply and suddenly in September 2014, as we talked about earlier. So this is just an attempt to make sense of the of a very messy information picture. It could well be that that a lot of our data are wrong, and that it's too early to code these plots because they're not, the investigation isn't over yet, and there may have been IS connections that haven't been reported in the media and so on. That may well be true, but at least we've contributed a sort of a framework that can be used with better data, for the same analytical purpose.
Since you finished drafting this paper in mid-June, have you been continuing to track these trends? And have there been any changes or differences maybe in the last 2 months? Or is it more or less similar to what you were seeing a couple months ago?
We've been collecting data because we hope to kind of do an update at some point. But so far, we don't see any major changes. There haven't been any plots that seem to have been, you know, of type one or type two. Most of the things that have happened seem to be on the lower end of the scale as well. So, and in fact, you know, the last case of, you know, reasonably well confirmed sort of leadership involvement or cadre involvement, you know, is the Virvir attack in January of this year, you know, where, you know, several sources have indicated that the cell in Verviers were in touch with cadres of IS. But since then, you know, we haven't seen any cases in which you know, a link to the senior leadership has been claimed. So again, basically, you know, we're not seeing, you know, a rapid rapid increase in the number of directed plots. But as we say towards the end, you know, we can't predict the future. We don't know where this will go, and I think it's very dangerous to sort of use sort of past data like this to predict about the future, because the decision to go global, the decision to kind of launch more central guided attacks probably lies in the hands of a very small number of people, and these are also people that are very ideological, and they're also strategic, of course, but you know, there is, you know, these are ideologically committed, you know, people, and they're you know, they're living a clandestine life, you know, and there are few in number. So, and in those cases, it's very difficult to predict, you know, what they will do. There is an element of contingency here that we simply cannot sort of quantify or you know, be, you know, or capture, I think, as analysts. And so we're basically saying, you know, at the moment, you know, they haven't really gone global, but we really don't want to place our bets on whether they, you know, they might in the future.
Well, I think we'll leave the discussion there, and I'm sure we'll know more as things continue to play out. But thanks for coming onto the show today, Thomas.
Thanks so much for having me.
No problem. And for those interested in Thomas's and Peter's article, as well as the many other great pieces, check out the new edition of the Perspectives on Terrorism.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings between August 3rd and August 9th.
During that time period, AQAP announced conducting 15 military operations, while 3 foreign fighters were officially announced killed in Syria over that time span as well.
On August the 3rd, Jabhat al-Nusra's judiciary, Dar al-Qaeda in Haraitan, Aleppo, executed 2 women by stoning. One of the women slept with her son, and the other slept with her nephew. The son and nephew were shot to death. They weren't previously married and thus weren't stoned. They also announced that one man had been stoned to death for sodomy.
On August 4th, Jaish Muhammad fi Bilad al-Sham takes students from its Sharia Institute on a field trip to a pool for kids to swim.
On August 4th, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State lifts barriers using cranes to open roads in Al-Wahda neighborhood of Tal Afar.
On August 4th as well, Wilayat Hama of the Islamic State shows off its veterinary pharmacy.
On August 5th, there was the graduation of a new class from Al-Shaykhain training camp in Wilayat Al-Anbar of the Islamic State.
On the same day, Wilayat al-Khair of the Islamic State receives Muslims displaced from al-Jura and regime areas.
On August the 6th, Wilayat Ijla of the Islamic State creates a fence on each side of the road for a bridge in al-Sharqat district.
On the 8th, a Libyan foreign fighter died in Wilayat Salah ad-Din of the Islamic State inside of Iraq.
Also on the 8th, Wilayat al-Furat of the Islamic State shows off its children's medical clinic in al-Bukamal, Syria.
On August 9th, a new class enters the Cubs Institute for Children in Wilayat Khair of the Islamic State.
Also on the 9th, the first phase and surveying of the landscape for establishing new sidewalks and pathways in al-Shura in Wilayat Dijla of the Islamic State.
On the 9th also, Wilayat al-Khair of the Islamic State repairs a bridge crossing in Ma'adan.
And finally, also on the 9th, a Sudanese foreign fighter died in a suicide operation in Wilayat al-Barqa of the Islamic State in Darna, Libya. If you have any feedback, you can email podcast@jihadology.net or find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the show, please consider taking a moment to rate and review it in iTunes, which will help more people find the podcast.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Thomas for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.